Mike Cherney and
Aaron Blumenthal.
And we are recording episode one of Two Halves Make a Whole. Our name came from the two of us having an interesting family background. And whenever we hang out, we tend to talk about different types of finances. We wanted to share some of those thoughts and feelings with you guys and hopefully impart some knowledge. And hopefully you find some value out of it.
And if nothing else, we're drinking wine during the middle of a pandemic in a garage. So not everything's bad.
Things could always be worse.
Today's brought to you by Pinot Noir. Cheers.
What kind?
My house is the one with the giant menorah, so it wasn't very hard to find. But other than that, there's a lot that's been going on recently.
There has. I think the stock market over this last year has been ridiculous.
Volatile, yeah.
Volatile. And a lot of people, unfortunately, really got hammered by it going down back in February, which scared a lot of people out of the market. A lot of selling. And I'll say a lot of actually really good opportunities despite that.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because it's one of those, you know, the basic tenets of long-term finance is just kind of hold on and ride the storm, ride the wave. Because if you look at the, like, any chart that dates back to sort of the beginning of the stock market, it always goes up, like, over time. Even when we thought the sky was falling in the 1930s, it still went up. It's not like this is, so human nature, though, says to do something else, right? It's, you know, Richard Thaler won a Nobel Prize for behavioral economics because while it's evident, right, you know, people are going to be irrational, the fact that he was able to be like, no, here's why, is the reason he won it. You know, it's one of those, it's when you hear something and it's obvious and you're like, okay, like, why is this not a thing already?
But it is. And it's where some of those opportunities and where almost some of the predictability of the market comes from, because you see people acting on those irrational behaviors, and then it becomes almost a rational method of inputting, selling, buying within the market or when to hold on. And you see those huge drops and you can look at them as like, holy shit, everything's bad. Yeah. Or you can look at it as, this might be a little too much selling. Maybe this is where I come in. Or when you see things that are way high and you start to see those resistance patterns of where people begin to sell, it's not because there's actually anything wrong with that stock that it's going to turn around from that point or go up from a dip. It's literally that same exact irrational or rational behavior, depending on how you look at it, to be able to sell or buy at those times because it is either oversold or overbought.
Yeah. I mean, if you, like, a lot of that's even just baked into sort of the origins of the stock market, right? It literally started under one tree in Midtown Manhattan. The name Wall Street actually refers to the physical place. There was actually a wall on Wall Street. But it started out as basically people taking bets on companies and specifically like on intelligence from companies. So it actually started, it was like around the same time the Telegraph started coming around is when it really kind of picked up. And so people making these bets and saying that these things are going to go bad, this is going to happen. And just sort of, it's been baked in for so long, you know, that like these patterns exist. People would buy things and they would sell things. And it didn't really change until, what, the 1980s as well, when you had the invention of the advent of the computer in stock market and in the stock market and changing from a machine that literally had to type it into the terminal to just being able to plug the terminal in. And so, yeah, it's like a lot of this is just based off of, you know, people seeing these things and creating algorithms to adjust it. So why not use your own algorithm?
Yeah, absolutely. And people's predictable behavior is a great way to go off of it.
Oh, yeah.
And with that change of the computers, and you see all these smaller brokerages like Robinhood and even PayPal to some extent getting into trading, you have smaller and smaller investors that can get in with smaller and smaller denominations of investment amounts, and they don't need to buy 100 block of shares. They don't need to buy 1,000 block of shares. They can buy a portion of one share, and that drives the volume through the roof, which then leads to crazy buying like Tesla's sky-high valuation right now.
Yeah, that one I find so fascinating. Yes, the cars are fun. I've driven one and it was awesome, but to be valued more than other companies that ostensibly even have more throughput in terms of like their finances themselves.
Oh, 100%.
It seems crazy.
It is. Just having invested in Tesla several times and having invested in other automakers, I mean, it's worth 10 times Ford. It's worth more than 2 times ExxonMobil, yeah. And their profits legitimately only come from taxpayer dollars in the form yeah. of EV credits and CAFE fuel exemptions. Yeah. So they're actually selling credits to companies like Chrysler, who's got a very non-fuel efficient fleet. They're losing money on their cars.
Yeah, it's very interesting, especially because if you look at GM and Ford, their assets just like alone should make the company valued higher, but that's not how the market works, which is what's super fascinating about this, like specifically Tesla as that case, you know. I mean, also the fact that the vehicles that are going to be coming out from like Ford in the next couple of years, same with GM,
some pretty sweet cars.
Oh yeah, all the electric vehicles they're working on, like the turbines and stuff, and even just like the vehicle sharing that they're looking at. That's all, it should change the market, but it's just like people aren't forward thinking.
That or just that the yeah. publicity Tesla has around their vehicles, just, I mean, they don't have to do any marketing and everybody knows who they are.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true because of the sheer fact that Elon Musk exists as a human.
Because he is their marketing vehicle?
Oh, yeah.
His Twitter account?
Yes, that is not, like, it's not even fair. But, you know, it's sort of the Thomas Alva Edison effect, right? Like, Edison didn't actually do much of the inventing.
No. He's kind of a prick.
Oh, he was a terrible person. Do you know what, like, he owned the patent for like, the original movie cameras. And he went in and he had thugs smash up several studios.
So he could sell. So he was like the door salesman who had the guy going around with an axe breaking down people's doors.
A little bit worse, because people respected him.
A lot. Yeah, it's interesting. Speaking of the actual Tesla, because he wanted to work for Edison, had a huge appreciation for the guy.
Massive. And he was brilliant. Like, the other thing is, like, Tesla, I mean, the actual Tesla came up with a non-contact valve system that's a one-way valve that literally, like, look up the Tesla valve, it'll blow your mind. It took me a lot more time to figure it out than I'd like to admit to, but the fact that he was the one that drove that, I guess pun intended in that, and it's a one-way valve, but like, yeah, like all of the technology really came from him, where Edison had an idea and kind of drunkenly was like, okay, like, so do this, like, and he had a bunch of people working for him.
And he was a stubborn bastard too. I mean, really, when you think about, so he ran, the reason he became so famous was he ran all those generators back in New York with DC current, and he had fires and all sorts of other serious hazards pumping that much amperage through his lines, and he had to make bigger and bigger and bigger copper conductive cables to get power out to further reaches of the city. And you had Tesla come in with alternating current, and Edison, you know, the genius that he was, dismissing it, saying it'll never take off and it's worthless technology.
And we use alternating current in pretty much everything. There's very, very little things that don't use alternating current that aren't, you know, things that we use every day.
Like all of our power tools.
Like literally everything that we design. Yes, exactly. But no, it's crazy. Like, thinking about, it's not necessarily the first person with the best idea, but the one that get the best publicity. Because, you know, people say Henry Ford invented the automobile. He had nothing to do with the invention. He just invented a better way of making it quicker. Like, that, yes, that he did.
Funny story too. He worked for Edison.
Yeah, he was also a monster of a human being.
A little bit, yeah.
He was an actual slave plantation in Brazil.
Didn't hear about that one.
Oh yeah, no, he had a plantation in Brazil where he brought people in. A lot of them were indigenous, and then a lot of the others were. I don't really actually know much about the whole history of it, but it was right before, I think it was World War I. So there was like some shortage of rubber, and so he wanted to have a rubber plant. So he made this city and had them make rubber for him.
For car tires.
For car tires.
Interesting. Didn't know that. Learn something new every day. Even when trying to impart knowledge.
Yes.
So we've gone on a bit of a tangent out to, to car makers. Yeah, that's kind of pretty standard.
Yeah, it's about
par for the course for us. Going back to the stock market, though, yes. I mean, if we're looking at how these companies have gone up and down, and you look at a company like Tesla with a $600 billion market cap now, which is, that's where Apple was 5 years ago, right about?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Selling millions and millions and millions of iPhones at crazy margins. And you got Tesla selling cars at razor-thin margins, not very many of them. And somehow they're worth about the same as Apple was back then. And, you know, you take go into famous people and their quotes and what they've done with Warren Buffett, right? The undisputed,
world champion, if you will.
Right, yeah, in the stock market. And one of his famous quotes is, be greedy when others are fearful and be fearful when others are greedy. And I look at Tesla, and personally speaking, right? Now, you can invest in however you want, but I'm not buying them anytime soon.
No.
It's a fool's game to what kind of gains are you going to make at this point trying to go for something that is at such a sky high valuation?
It just doesn't pass the sniff test. You know, it's like also quoting like Warren Buffett, trade in things you know. And the fact of the matter is, I don't really know why Tesla's valued so highly. I get it in the one sense, but it doesn't pass my like feel right test. Not that, as we talked about at the beginning, emotions are what I should be using, but
right
at the same time...
For those predictable behaviors.
Exactly. The fact that everybody feels this is predictably good is making me worry why it's something's there that isn't.
Absolutely. And again, it ties back to all those little brokerages because people couldn't afford the Tesla stock price when it was $1,400 a share before the split. And now that it's up in the 500s again, I mean, you're sitting here wondering, well... What if I don't have $500? What if I don't have $5,000 or $50,000 to invest in 100 shares? Well, you can just buy a portion of a share, $20 a week. That's really not too bad. It really doesn't cost you that much. And I mean, if the stock's going to the moon, why not jump on board? But you start to get all these massive volume drives, and the company's taking advantage of it. So if you figured that they thought the stock was going to continue going up, they wouldn't be selling $5 billion worth of shares like they did this last week, which inevitably drove the stock back down.
I mean, clearly, yeah. I mean, the other thing that you also have going on at the same time is the rise of index funds, like super low cost index funds. And so that also goes along with what you're talking about.
Higher volume.
Yeah, with the super small brokerages, right? Because everybody's doing that at this point. Well, not everybody, but there is a whole movement, right? There's literally, you can go online and they're called bogleheads, right? The people that are, going with Bogle, who is the founder of Vanguard, which is like one of the first ETFs, not the first, but one of them.
Probably one of the most successful.
Absolutely. It's them and BlackRock, I think, are the two that are now like the real...
Big kings, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing that's interesting about that is one of the original arguments against index funds was that it's anti-capitalist and it's anti-democratic, which I didn't understand until recently. And basically what they're saying is because you're buying everything and because you're doing it in such a way that it actually reduces the entire market volatility, and to some extent some of the volatility that we've seen shouldn't be happening if everybody was actually buying index funds or if people were buying more of them. So that means there's still some uncertainty in the market that's, like we talked about before, is baked in, but even that shouldn't necessarily be there. So that comes from perceptions.
100%. For anyone who doesn't really know what or how that kind of plays out to what Aaron's talking about is, if you buy a big pool of different stocks in an index fund or an ETF, that ETF or that index fund is basically a collection of a bunch of smaller stocks.
Yeah.
And so even if one of those stocks has a huge movement up or down, the effect on the rest of them is kind of buffered. So if you were to put $1,000 in and most of your stuff stays flat and one of those things that was in that collection of stocks jumps or falls, your overall movement, even if that stock did 50% in either direction, would maybe be a few percent, depending on how heavily weighted it was within that fund.
It's like, another way of thinking about it, baking related, is it's like a quiche. You can throw whatever you want into a quiche and it'll come out okay.
It's really come full circle here.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. We were talking about bacon before this, so that's why it's full circle for right now. But basically you can change any of the ingredients up and down, even a substantial amount, and it's really not gonna, it's still gonna be a quiche, right? Like, unless you get rid of eggs, which we're gonna just call stocks for at this point, it's still a quiche. So it's like, it doesn't really, that's another way of thinking about it. It's like, you are buying the whole market, but it's just those proportions that really drives the performance of the individual fund.
Absolutely. And actually, on top of that, so speaking of Tesla again, kind of jumping back over to it, is they're going to be joining the S&P 500 as the biggest stock ever to join the index, which then drives higher volume. Again, not just like Robinhood or these other smaller brokerages that are allowing people to do fractional buying, but now all the big funds like Vanguard and BlackRock, who have funds within their company that track the S&P 500, they now have to buy Tesla in order to match the S&P 500. So they're going to buy those 500 shares in the same proportions as the index does, weighted accordingly. So now you're going to drive even more volume to a stock that's been pumped way beyond what it could be, which is actually really bad if you own one of these S&P 500 stocks, because if Tesla does come back to earth after joining that fund, right, even if Tesla falls 50%, right, goes to a $300 billion valuation, it still is going to have an impact, right? If you're looking for an 8 to 10% growth on an annual basis in those funds, and you were doing pretty good, say you're up 5% for this year, it'd be really good on an annualized basis. But if Tesla now joins that fund, say, before the end of this month or beginning of next month, all of a sudden you're going to lose a lot of those gains, because even if they lose 50%, that's 5% on your fund.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, if you think about it, that's where along with that exchange-traded fund activity that we're seeing, which also we should mention that exchange-traded funds are slightly different than mutual funds, which are also different than hedge funds, right? These are all different ways of kind of pooling money and buying stocks. So if you think about it, the exchange-traded fund, as you alluded to, basically you are buying something that the proportion's essentially chosen, right? Like, it's not going to change unless the S&P 500 changes, or unless there's some sort of other change going on, right? But a mutual fund is actively traded as opposed to passively traded. And so those are going to be changing a lot of the time. Hedge funds are basically people who are magicians that say they know what's going on, and they say, I have this algorithm, or I have a specific interesting way of looking at something, and they're going to trade stocks based off of that. For the most part, hedge fund managers, while fun to show in TV shows and in movies, really aren't the drivers of the economy. It's BlackRock.
Yeah, they're really not. And they're few and far between. They play with huge pools of money, though.
That's true,
from a smaller group of clientele, right? They're not going to pull like a Vanguard for everyone's retirement fund and every company that they have some money in there. They've got very wealthy people that are willing to take a bet to be able to potentially make 20% to 100% in a year. And even when you look at that, so sure, it could be a really good return, but they don't always have very good returns. And oftentimes actively trading like that, even from people that claim to know things, they don't always necessarily outperform the market. And when we look at the beginning of this year, when a lot of the signals were very clear that the market was going to take a dump, those hedge fund managers lost a ton of money.
Oh, my days. Yeah. Lots of haircuts everywhere.
Lots of haircuts. Yep. A lot of heads, I'm sure, rolled in some of those fund accounts. I'm sure a lot of people probably needed a change of shorts after seeing what the market did a few of those days.
There were a few days where I remember I sent you messages at work where I'm like, this is fun. And I feel like my voice was implied. But no, it's crazy what's going on out there. But along with that, there's also this like FIRE movement, which I know I'm now bouncing around, but like FIRE, which is financial independent, retire early, a lot of those people are going to get hosed soon if when Tesla goes on the S&P 500, and when I think invariably it's going to crash. But
and again, these are our opinions. Definitely not a prediction of what's going to happen, just absolutely. What we believe is coming.
These are not predictions. These are speculations of two people drinking wine. don't take this to the bank, so to speak, quite literally actually. But But yeah, no, it's going to be interesting to see how that affects that, because a lot of these individuals are purchasing these, like, these index funds and saying, okay, I know that this has, you know, a return rate of X, I know what to invest. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that affects those people's calculations. And a lot of those guys are also, you know, Joe Schmoes that are doing Monte Carlo simulations in Excel, trying to figure out what the actual rates of things are going to be. But it is an interesting paradigm that's coming up at the same time, right? It's sort of the homebrew versus mega brew in, you know, the beer when that happened in the 1970s, but now it's actually able to happen because of those, like, that increase in the smaller brokerages and those things. Because you're not... I remember, man, this is going to make me sound old, but I remember when I was younger and I had an idea of what I wanted to trade, and I had to ask my dad, who then had to call a stockbroker, who basically I found out a week later whether or not I actually bought my stock. And now I'm wearing sweatpants and I can do it
from your couch or your bed or anywhere.
Yeah, toilet.
Yeah. It's ambitious.
Where most things happen. Most good things. But not most good things. It's weird. But we'll go with that. But no, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with that. Because that's...
You really haven't seen people in a long time.
Oh my God, I haven't. No, I told you, dude. Yeah, I've been very sequestered away, guys. So, but no, they are the equivalent to trading as, like, people who track their runs are to fitness. If you think about it, I mean, that's really what they are. It's people who track, you know, their running and everything like that. They do it in apps or they have spreadsheets, and that's exactly what these guys are. So it's sort of this weird microcosm of that.
It's almost like having someone else count your steps for you.
Pretty much. That's, yeah. which takes us to a previously mentioned topic, which is government intervention and surveillance. And by that, I'm slightly kidding, but not too much.
Maybe a topic for another time.
Obviously. But no, it is interesting to see what's going on out there, and to see what people are going to do with it is going to be very intriguing.
So what do you think about going back to, for the people that are kind of worried, like, well, what if the market goes up? What if it goes down? I want to be in a safe spot. Do you think it's worth going back to, like, the, I don't know, the old rhetoric of, I'll say, our grandparents of, I like investing in a utility company. It's really stable. They pay good dividends.
5 years ago, maybe. The reason is PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, right?
Mm.
So several utilities actually aren't doing well, specifically on the coasts, places that are being directly affected by increases in temperature and changing climate. So there is some interesting things in there, but for the most part, yes. I would say with exceptions.
But I feel like those are kind of our exceptions, aren't they, with PG&E?
Oh, yeah. They're totally edge cases. I get that, but...
I'm talking more of, even if you're not looking at just energy utilities, what about, like, telecom utilities?
I think those would be fine, especially considering, like, the changing the guard right now, you know, at the SEC... the FCC. Oh, man, I can't speak today. The move from Ajit Pai to sort of what's going on, or whoever's actually, I don't know if he's chosen, if Joe Biden has chosen who's going to be in charge of the FCC, but the changing towards net neutrality, I think, is only actually going to help these telecom companies.
In what way?
I feel like there's going to be a slight outpouring of goodwill that's going to be coming up soon. This is based entirely off of just seeing how people reacted previously at the beginning of the previous administration, or current administration, to Ajit Pai and to what was going on at the FCC, and how that caused a negative effect and depressed some of their stocks. So I think the opposite is going to happen. I think in the long run, they're only going to go up, right? Because of everything being IoT, Internet of Things, everything is being connected. we are sitting in a garage that's where we have Wi-Fi beamed into it from a house that's like 20 meters away, you know, nah, probably like 10 meters away. But still, like, the fact that that's happening, it's only going to get better.
Yeah, I'd agree.
What do you think? I know I like to talk, so like, you talk. Come on. Let me drink.
I would agree. I think in the telecom space, there's a lot of room for additional growth. You have 5G coming in, which is just going to connect even more devices, right? Like, when you talk about the revolution of what the cell phone did, you start getting connected cars as electric cars start to take more of a fit into the market versus just a small niche. There's additional room for what other things can you connect to those huge networks that Verizon and AT&T and companies like them have laid out.
Yeah.
But just looking at what the market's doing right now in terms of telecom is those stocks are actually not performing quite that well. And I don't know if that's a precursor to what might come or they've just kind of been overlooked with hotter stocks on the market. But I've been investing in AT&T on and off over the last, I'll say, 10, 11 years.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing that's always attracted me to them is their really high dividend payout. And the stock has gone through some, I'll say, turbulent times over the last couple of years. They bought DirecTV. Now they're actually trying to divest DirecTV.
Yeah.
So their stock took quite a plunge. They were up in the $40 range a couple of years ago when they bought DirecTV. Stock dropped into the 30s. Yeah. Now they were quite depressed in the 20s, which is about an 11-year discount if you think about their stock price.
Oh, yeah.
Which the company has – they're one of very few dividend aristocrats. And that meaning that they've over the – basically the course of their history have never missed a dividend payment and have raised their dividends on an annual basis.
Yeah. That's – it's going to be interesting to continue watching that, especially because, you know, the rate of dividends – like, and I guess more appropriately, the number of companies that are still doing dividends is not that big. I mean, at least if you look at, like, historical levels,
right,
we're super, super low. And I wonder if that's going to start coming back.
It might. A lot of companies got scared with the cash crunch they had this year, and they started cutting back on them, either pausing them like Ford did, which was at about a 10% payout at the price before they decided to cut back on it.
Oh, yeah.
But AT&T's been holding strong and they've had really great cash flow. I mean, you have subscribers, so it's not like you're just not going to buy a car, which was Ford's issue.
Yeah.
You're going to continue to pay your cell phone bill. So they have a constant revenue stream coming in. They have government contracts. They've got networks all over the country and the world. So with that huge revenue stream, and they just bumped their dividend again, they're at about 7% payout right now.
Dang.
Definitely better than you're going to get in the bank.
Actually, a surprisingly high dividend company, Mattel.
Interesting.
Yeah, toys.
Yeah.
I don't remember what it was recently, but I was pleasantly surprised when I saw, like, at the beginning of the pandemic, I was like, all right, when Christmas time comes, people are going to want to buy ridiculous things, right? And especially because we've all been cooped up. And so I saw the writing on the wall basically at the beginning. So I invested some money in that. And then I looked at my account recently and I saw that I had a dividend payment from them. And I'm like, didn't even realize that.
Huh.
Yeah. It kind of blew my mind.
What payout ratio do they have?
I don't remember offhand. Like I said, it was one of those, I'll pull it up, but I looked at it and I was like, interesting. Let's see here. Of course, I brag about my internet out here, and now I can't get anything out. Let's see here. Dividend. It is...
It's even better than finding $20 in your pocket when you first put your coat back on in the winter.
Yeah. Oh, no. Apparently, they recently cut it, is what I'm getting, but... I don't know if I'm currently... Oh. Maybe it wasn't for them. I thought I saw something in there that was a dividend.
Could have been a special dividend.
Yeah, it's possible. Hmm. Well, apparently they did it for decades, and then they stopped recently. So I am completely wrong.
It's just another one of those examples of companies cutting back on them.
Yeah. Dang. But still, yeah, that's... They had apparently 2 decades worth of dividends, and then just, recently stopped. Hmm.
that's pretty similar to Ford's story. They paid dividends for a lot of their history, but when times get tough, they are one of those companies that cuts back to save cash.
I can't remember. Is General Electric still doing dividends?
They are. It's super small. I think they pay like a penny right now.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, that is a company that had a ton of assets and then kind of...
just been liquidating all of them.
Oh my God, yeah.
We have come full circle again because they were started by Thomas Edison.
This is true.
It's kind of weird when you think about the company is founded upon almost inferior technology.
Oh, yeah. But they basically controlled
everything
for a long period of time.
They were the bellwether for the stock market.
Yeah. And actually, even like most modern governance models for companies originated with GE, right? Like, wasn't it?
Jack Welch.
Exactly. It was Jack Welch. So, yeah, there's a ton there. That history is interesting, and we should probably do a podcast about that at some point.
Absolutely. No, there's a lot of good MBA podcasts. A lot of good MBA case studies on GE.
Oh, I'm sure.
On just studying success and then subsequent failure.
Yeah.
Rise and fall of a juggernaut.
Well, I think the thing that's so fascinating about them is that you have a company like Siemens, right? Or even Bosch. Like, companies that do everything that are, you know, mostly foreign-based, right? There still are a few in the United States that do a ton of things. But for the most part, you have, like, ThyssenKrupp, which I think is also German.
Yep.
And then one company that does a surprising number of things is Rolls-Royce. You have Rolls-Royce engines, and then you have Rolls-Royce, the car company.
Yep.
And the engine part, I think, outperforms the automobile part, if I'm not mistaken, because it's most airplanes either use Pratt & Whitney or Rolls-Royce. Some use GE.
Some use GE, yep.
But for the most part, it's like it's those three.
Yeah.
And it's just something that you don't associate, because you associate it with that like flashy, you know, 1920s guy that's smoking a cigar or a cigarette on one of those weird stick things that I still don't understand how they work.
Yeah. But Rolls-Royce engines were in a lot of fighter planes for the British back in the early World Wars.
Yeah. I think they still do a couple jet engines for, I think it's the RAF Tornado, which is a British plane. So it makes sense. But yeah, there's a bunch of companies out there that you associate with one thing, right? Bosch Power Tools, but they literally make everything.
Yeah, they're huge in automotive, not just making tools.
Exactly. Siemens, most people associate them with their routers or modems or telecom communications, but...
logic controllers.
Trains.
Trains, yeah.
They make a ton of different things. Elevators, even.
Yeah, or the thermostat in your house.
This is true, yeah. So it's interesting that those companies are still surviving. And then you also have the darlings of Korea, right? Like, most of these companies out, like in South Korea, make everything from cars to cell phones to TVs to
Hyundai.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're huge. They decided to get in the car market not too long ago, and they have been pretty successful.
I remember when they were a punchline when we were in high school, and now I wouldn't not be embarrassed. Is that the right way of saying it? I would be fine having one.
I still wouldn't have one, but they've garnered my respect.
Fair. I have a wife, and I will do as I'm told. But we'll edit that out, so don't worry. But no, it's interesting to like watch the rise of these super giants, but then see ones that are here fail is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, leadership is everything, right? Even when we look at our own company.
Yeah.
Right? It's 12 years ago, really on the brink, Milwaukee Tool was on the brink of failure. And coming in with new leadership revitalized the company, and we've been on a rocket ride since.
Yeah, we used to be owned by Atlas Copco.
Yeah, what a disaster.
Oh, geez. Yeah, but that's another company that does everything. Not everything, but they do, like...
yeah, they're a conglomerate of sorts.
Yeah, they're a weird conglomerate of, like, manufacturing support stuff.
Which is weird. When you start to look at some of these companies that own a whole bunch of other companies, it's, in some sense, like being a fund manager. But they're trying to operate the company in addition to just holding stock in those companies.
Well, I mean, think about, like, talking about, you know, Warren Buffett and the S&P 500 and then stocks that are being changed down there. BNSF used to be a component of the S&P 500, and that's really how Berkshire Hathaway became what it is, right, on the stock market, is because of that purchase of BNSF. So, and that's a company, Berkshire Hathaway, that literally has its hands in everything.
Yep, and they use insurance to finance a lot of it.
Oh, yeah.
Purchase of Geico, yep.
Government Employee Insurance Company.
That's right.
Which is
hilarious, because...
Still funny.
Yep, because they insure all the private citizens that aren't related with the government.
Oh, yeah.
Or aren't employed by the government, I should say.
I can't even remember what Berkshire Hathaway originally made. I think it was clothing, if I remember.
I think it was a textile mill, if I'm not mistaken. And he came in, and they were really struggling, and he bought them and basically turned around their operations and started using the funds that they were getting to start acquiring other companies. And eventually that they shut down the textile production and just continued growing. Yeah.
Well, I think that's like an interesting note. If you guys haven't read The Goal, it is a tremendous book. And it talks about operations management and how to do some of that stuff. It's
how to keep your eye on the prize.
Yeah, exactly. It has a cheesy story. A very not great story, but I will articulate that again. It is not a good story, but it is the most engaging textbook I ever had. And it taught me a lot. Like watching and realizing that the goal of the title references the goal of every firm is to make money. Right? And there's two ways you can do that. It's profit equals, you know, revenue minus cost. So, okay, you either increase revenue or you decrease cost, and you do whichever is the easiest at the moment, essentially. And you try with you know, an eye towards long-term growth, but
right.
But like that's the lesson right there. You know, that's essentially what everybody in the stock market and people looking at stocks are trying to do.
Yeah, it's just how you envision that goal to be, right? There's a lot of people, and exactly. I'm sure all of you know, or you can think back to your own history of buying and selling things where you held way too long, sold way too early, sold at the wrong time, bought at the wrong time, and it was without having that eye on the prize of, you know, what's your entry point and what's your target? What are you realistically looking to do with it? Is it supposed to be a long-term play? Is it supposed to be short-term? Is it supposed to be speculative? And if you go in with that mindset, it makes the purchase and sale a lot easier, and you don't really have that remorse after doing it because you really knew what you were doing going in. Even if you didn't know the outcome, right, or the outcome didn't go your way, you had a plan in place versus just saying, I'm going to make a lot of money on this thing, and I'm going to buy it and sell it when I think it's good.
Well, that's like the whole, you know, knowing what you want, right, which is like 90% of it. It's the simplest thing you can do to make money is to figure out what your actual goal is. I mean, it sounds boring, and it doesn't sound very fun, but in all seriousness, like, what is your goal? What is a comfortable life, or what are you trying to achieve? Because that's going to determine the rest of it, right? It's like I said, it's not sexy, but it's true. Like, if you want to make money, that is one specific thing. If you just want to be comfortable, that's another. And so I think figuring out what you want, what your true desire is like, I think the crux of a lot of what we're also talking about, if you think about it, because it's one of those like, yeah, if you want to make money, that's a very specific thing. And then you need to know, okay, when do I need it? Right? Because that's going back to what you're talking about. Is it long-term? Is it short-term? You know, because if it's short-term, that's going to be different. Now you're going to be looking at puts and other different devices and things out there to try to kind of create leverage and to do these and different things. But if you're trying to do something long term, that's different. And then that's where you're going to really have to go against your nature, human nature.
Right.
As we were talking about at the beginning.
Because you're going to be looking at, well, but it's up right now. Do I take it now? And it comes back to your goal. And if your goal was to make money over the long term and just hold an investment, for the discipline of holding that investment, you have to have that discipline.
Yeah. But once again, that's going to come from the way you can build that discipline. In the words of Epictetus, you know, or any of your Stoic philosophers, is going to be figuring out what you want. Because if you don't know that, then yeah, it's just nothing else matters. And this is what we call In Vino Veritas. Like I said, it is Pinot Noir is bringing this here today. So,
but absolutely.
But seriously, yeah, that's like, I'd say that's the biggest thing, is like figuring out your why.
Yeah, kind of like, I want to do this.
Pretty much, yeah. Cheers.
Now we just need to get ourselves on a regular cadence to hold these podcasts and.
Hell yeah, dude.
Impart our random thoughts, knowledge, and ramblings on the ears of others.
Yeah, and you unsuspecting people. But, and I will have Google next time, too.
Oh, absolutely. That'd be perfect.
I am an okay baker, guys, which also requires forethought, as I found out today when I've already ruined 2 batches of things. So.
Humble.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about that.
A lot better than he lets on.
The inside of my house smells bad right now because of that. So, which is the reason we're not inside of it. It smells burnt. It smells like someone left fish sticks in there for too long, despite there being no fish in the house.
Reminds me of a South Park episode.
Oh my gosh, yes. That's right. Actually, yeah. That's a different story.
So, hopefully, if you guys like what we're all about, and be looking forward to sharing a few more podcasts and see where things go.
Absolutely.
And I'm Mike Cherney.
And I'm Aaron Blumenthal.
And we're 2 halves make a whole.
We're both here to help.